little warning before we get started here. I suppose this sermon, you could say it's rated PG, because it does have Jacob's encounter with Leah here, and it will have some reflections upon sex. So wanted to just warn any of you who would like to have children who would not hear that, that you can feel free to leave, and I won't hold it against you. Well, this drama illustrates a certain desperation, right? It's a desperation for love. And, you know, perhaps we're getting more inventive in our ways of looking for love and finding love, but maybe not, because there's nothing really new under the sun. But one thing that has changed is we seem to be airing our ways publicly on a weekly basis on reality TV shows. Jacob was our subject. He was desperate for love. Jacob was an exile from his family. His father didn't love him. His brother wanted to kill him. He went a long way away from home in order to look for a wife. But his ways of going about it are somewhat wayward. His ways of looking for love are less than exemplary. So the Lord, who has promised to be with Jacob in this new land, in Haran, disciplines Jacob. The Lord, in his love, disciplines Jacob in his wayward ways of love in order to expand Jacob's capacity to receive the Lord and to understand him and to know him and to love him. Well, our ways may be desperate as well. Desperately we want love. And sometimes this doesn't end in marriage. We still desperately want some kind of companionship that brings us something more. And perhaps our ways, like Jacob's, at times get somewhat wayward. But we can be thankful because the Lord is with us in our land. The Lord is with us if we are dwelling in a land that feels something like Haran. And he disciplines us in that place, in our wayward ways. He does so in order to show us himself, in order to reveal himself to us in deeper dimensions of who he is. So we're going to pick up the story in Genesis chapter 29. So please turn with me there. We're going to pick it up in the middle of Genesis 29. At the beginning of Genesis 29, we looked at it last week. Jacob has come to Haran. He has come to Haran looking for a wife. He thinks he has met the woman of his dreams in Rachel, meets her at the well. The only problem is Rachel has a father, and that father is Laban. And Laban has different ideas for what for Jacob's life. And there is going to be this negotiation and bargaining, and Jacob is going to get into all sorts of trouble because of his connection now with Laban. So first of all, we see in Genesis chapter 29, verses 15 to 20, that Jacob works for Rachel. We're going to pick up the story in verse 14, picking up a little bit from last week. Then Laban said to him, that is to Jacob, you are my own flesh and blood. After Jacob had stayed with him a whole month, Laban said to him, just because you are a relative of mine, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me, what should your wages be? Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, I'll work for you 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel. Laban said, it is better to give her to you than to some other man. Stay here with me. So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel, but they seemed like only a few days to him because of his love for her. Let's stop there. So Laban talks about work and he talks about wages. Literally, he talks about service or being a servant. These are slavery type words. And this is Laban's world. In Laban's world, you work for love. In Laban's world, this is all about prospering from certain relationships that you have. Family relationships are equated to him as economic arrangements. And here he calls Jacob a relative, literally calls him his brother, but he is looking upon Jacob solely as a potential slave who can benefit him. He views his daughters even as economic commodities. He names them, interestingly enough, Leah, which means cow, and Rachel, only slightly better, which means you. Now, Laban was a herder, and so here are his daughters, who in his mind are nothing more than commodities to be bartered away for the right price. So along comes Jacob, and perhaps Jacob is going to offer the right price. Now, Jacob's bargaining position is extremely weak. When Abraham sent his servant to this same land, Haran, in order to search for a wife for his son Isaac, he supplied his servant with plenty of riches and gifts and resources in order to succeed in his search. Isaac, on the other hand, provides Jacob with absolutely nothing. And so here's this bargainer, the consummate bargainer and negotiator, Jacob, who really has nothing to bargain with. He prefers the beautiful daughter. Perhaps he thinks that Rachel's beauty will decorate his ugly life. The text literally says, "Now Jacob loved Rachel." You don't have to turn there, but almost the identical phrasing appears in Genesis 25, verse 28. Actually the same phrasing, different names inserted. "Now Isaac loved Esau." Now Jacob loved Rachel. Now Isaac loved Esau. Isaac loved Esau, not Jacob. He was wounded, Jacob was. Deeply wounded by the favoritism of his father who did not love him, who loved his brother instead. And now Jacob favors Rachel. And all seems well because he intends on marrying Rachel and Rachel alone. But as things unfold, he's going to end up with two wives, and he's also going to end up with Leah. And so here is the man, the son, who was wounded by the favoritism of his father, now becomes the husband who wounds his wife by his own favoritism. This favoritism has been passed on through the generations. Jacob makes an offer to work 7 years for Rachel, to work for love. And he's familiar with this. He's familiar with working for love. This was his world back in Canaan as well, back in the Promised Land, because his father didn't love him. So what did he do? He cooked stew, just like his brother did, his favorite brother did, in order to win the favor of his father. And finally, he actually dressed up like his brother, pretended that he was his brother, in order to win his father's love. But it didn't work. He may have won the birthright and the blessing, but he did not win his father's love. So his world has conditioned him for this, to work hard to earn love and to hope that after 7 years you might be able to get something of love. He makes this offer of 7 years. This must have been an exceptional offer because Laban is a consummate negotiator as well, and he accepts the offer right on the spot without even making a counteroffer. When Jacob came to this land, he expected it to be only a few days. He expected to find a wife in a few days and to return home. But now it's looking like a few days is turning into 7 years, and 7 years will turn into 14 years. And a few more years after that, it'll be 20 years that Jacob is in this land. He is now in the clutches of the treacherous Laban. Nevertheless, because of the beauty of Rachel and because of his love for Rachel, these days seemed like literally only a few in his eyes. In his eyes. That's a key term in the Jacob narrative. You see, because Isaac's eyes were dim. Isaac was too blind to see. Therefore, Jacob could take advantage of him, pretend that he was his brother, trick his father into giving him the blessing. As a result of all this, in the poetic justice of the Jacob narrative, he ends up with Leah, whose eyes are described as weak, a reference to her less than exciting appearance. So he works for Rachel. Beginning in verse 21, he sleeps with Leah. Let's pick it up there, verse 21. "Then Jacob said to Laban, 'Give me my wife. My time is completed, and I want to lie with her.' So Laban brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob, and Jacob lay with her. And Laban gave his servant girl Zilpah to his daughter as a maidservant. When morning came, there was Leah. So Jacob said to Laban, 'What is this you have done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me?' Laban replied, 'It is not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. Finish out this daughter's bridal week, then we will give you the younger one also, in return for another 7 years of work.' And Jacob did so. He finished out the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his servant girl Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as a maidservant. Jacob lay with Rachel also, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. And he worked for Laban another 7 years. So at the end of 7 years, Jacob has to go to Laban and beg for his wife. Laban seems none too willing to live up to his end of the bargain, although eventually he does, apparently. So he comes, Jacob does, to Laban and talks of Rachel, this woman he supposedly loves, as payment for services rendered. Do you see what this has done to Jacob? At first he loves her, and after 7 years of working for her, now something has happened to him that he thinks that she is payment for the services that he has offered to Laban. He has worked hard for this woman. And so his passions make him easy prey for Laban. It's very similar to what happened in Genesis chapter 25 when Esau's passions, his longing for food, longing for the stew, made him easy prey for Jacob. And Jacob was able to get the birthright from Esau for this stew. Now his passions make him easy prey for Laban. Laban substitutes Leah for Rachel. It's dark. Leah was veiled. And this is probably in the middle of a week-long wedding feast full of food and wine. Jacob has probably had his fill of food and wine, and he is feeling no pain at this point. And so in the end, he doesn't even know who he is with. He loves this woman, Rachel, and he doesn't even know that he's not with her. All he cares about at this point is relieving his pent-up passion. Jacob, who was unknown by his father, becomes the lover who does not even know who he is with. And Laban says, it is not our custom here regarding the firstborn. He doesn't use the word older. He uses literally the word firstborn. And with this word, Jacob's past comes crashing in on him. You see what happened? He pretended to be the firstborn. He pretended to be Esau when he came to his father Isaac in order to seek the blessing from Isaac. And Isaac was blind. Isaac could not see that it was Jacob. He thought it was Esau. And now, what has happened to Jacob? He's blind. Oh, he can see. His eyes are just fine. But in the dark and when he's drunk, he doesn't know who he was with. He's blind to see who this woman actually is. And the text last week told us earlier in Genesis chapter 29 that when Jacob came to Haran, he told Laban all these things. He probably told them about his life in Canaan. So Laban has this information. And what Laban is saying in so many words is, you may be able to get away with the old switcheroo back in your land, but here, let me tell you the way things are done. You don't get to marry the younger. The narrator would have us believe that divine justice and poetic justice is being served here. Well, Laban makes another offer. He says, you can have Rachel after this week-long feast, and you can be married to her as well, but I want you to work another 7 years for her. And Jacob, with a weak bargaining position, agrees. The text says that Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. And so here it is, the favoritism coming home to roost. Jacob passing on this favoritism. He loves Rachel more. And here is Jacob who the Lord has told him, you are destined to be a ruler. You are destined to be a ruler who begets rulers. And in Haran, he is nothing more than a slave, nothing more than a servant. And he will be that for 20 years. Jacob, the negotiator, has met his match in Laban. Now, of course, when we come to a story like this, we often wonder about what is this deal going on here with two wives? Is this okay? Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Well, the scriptures, the Old Testament, of course, they're filled with stories of multiple wives, not to mention multiple concubines. And so we want to know, what does all this mean? Well, invariably, whenever these stories happen, it leads to a mess. It results in regrettable consequences. And this story is going to result in a mess, regrettable consequences as well. In this way, the biblical storytellers are telling us that really it was God's intention from the beginning for there to be one man and one woman in this husband-wife relationship. In fact, when Jesus is asked about this question in the Gospels, he takes them back to the beginning. In the beginning, it was not always this way. It was supposed to be one man, one woman. Well, I would like to share with you three categories of reflections regarding this story that revolve around waiting for love, working for love, and God's discipline in the ways of love. First of all, Jacob, to his credit, waits 7 years before sleeping with Rachel. He doesn't actually sleep with Rachel, he sleeps with Leah. What a quaint concept. You don't sleep with somebody, you don't have sex with somebody until you get married. Laughably quaint, right, by today's standards? Who believes this anymore? Can you hardly even come to a TV show or a movie or a story or a novel in which this is not expected, that you would sleep with somebody that you love or are attracted to and have sex with that person? That seems to be the way of the world today. In fact, sex now has been elevated to the point, well, the scriptures elevated to an incredibly lofty place, but it's been moved to a place in our culture in which it is treated as a need. Sex is now understood to be a need. Now, of course, it is not a need. You need food, you need clothing, you need shelter. Those are needs. Sex is not a need. But now it is depicted as absolutely essential to human growth and to human fulfillment. And so the reasoning goes, if you need sex, you must do what you can do to get it. And if you can't get it, well, it's okay if you get something like it. What do the scriptures say about sex? Scriptures tell us that sex is a gift. God is absolutely wild about sex. It was his idea in the first place, of course. It's a gift to be received in his perfect timing when he knows how to give it and when to give it. And that gift is to be exercised and received in the context of marriage, according to the scriptures. What then do the scriptures say? And what do we say to those to whom the gift has not been given? Or to those to whom have received the gift and now have had it taken away for whatever reason, lost a marriage or a particular season in marriage in which sex is not possible? What do we say to those people? Well, the scriptures have basically one word for you. They have a multitude of words, but the essential advice and admonition comes down to one word. Wait. Wait. Key word in the scriptures. And this is active in all kinds of spheres, not just the sphere of sex. Wait in your career. You have to wait there. Wait in certain relationships. Wait even in the context of your relationship with the Lord. Wait. Those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength, according to Isaiah 40:31. Just one example from the scriptures regarding waiting. And as we wait for the Lord, for whatever it is we're waiting for, as time stretches out, so do our hearts. Our hearts stretch out. Our hearts become enlarged until one day it dawns on us that all this waiting has done something for me. That in this waiting, my heart has become bigger, it has become enlarged, and I am more able to receive the love of God. And the love of God penetrates my being in ever deeper places because I have been waiting and longing and hoping and praying, and my heart has stretched out for God. How long must we wait? Some of us are probably going to have to wait until the whole idea of sex, the whole idea of marriage, is consummated in the new heavens and the new earth, where Jesus says they neither marry nor are given in marriage. And let me assure you that those of you who are waiting and longing and desiring, that when you see Jesus face to face on that day, you will know that you have not missed out on one single thing. The scriptures teach that gaining new strength, gaining a deeper, bigger, more profound relationship with the Lord is infinitely better than sex on demand. These desires that we have, which are God-given, can lead to absolute disastrous choices unless we submit them to the scriptures and involve ourselves with a community of faith, people who are speaking into our lives, people that we are sharing with. Jacob has no spiritual center at this point in his life. The Lord has met him in a powerful way in Bethel, but Jacob forgets all about that when he gets to Haran, at least at first. Perhaps we are at the mercy of our desires without a spiritual center as well. And maybe, like Jacob, we wake up maybe 7 years later and find that we have made some terrible mistakes. We become addicted to pornography. We gave away something that we shouldn't have. We used somebody. Perhaps the person we're with, we don't even know. Maybe we've sacrificed our faith in Jesus. These desires and these hopes lead us to believe that something good is going to happen. But sometimes we end up feeling tricked. Tricked by the Labans of the world. Tricked by our own desires. And we end up with these consequences. Now, you won't learn about such consequences from watching television today. If you look at the sitcoms today, really what you can do, or what the characters can do, is they can trade partners at will. One week they can be with this person, another week they can be with this person, and there's really, you know, maybe a whimper or two, but nothing really bad happens. The worst that could happen, it seems, is from one of these encounters is that a baby results, as in the show Friends. But now I've seen three of those episodes, and by the way, you don't have to watch these things to actually know what they're about, because people talk about them, you read the newspaper and whatnot. And so I know what the show is about, even though I've only seen it three times. But does that baby ever cry? It was in that show? Does that baby ever inhibit anyone's lifestyle? That baby is not like my baby, let me tell you. It's no consequence. Sleep with who you want, no consequence. Waiting for love, the biblical admonition. Working for love, not the way God would have us do it. Perhaps like Jacob, some of us have become slaves, willing to work, slave away for love. And our world has conditioned us to do this. Our world, which knows little of love, little of real, genuine love, conditions us and makes us think that we have to look and that we have to act in very rigidly defined ways in order to get the love that we want. Many of us feel that our bargaining position is very weak. We don't have the looks, we don't have the charm, we don't have the resources. We don't really have what it takes to compete in this game of love. And sometimes that continues well into marriage. I was with a friend one time. Well, I brought my housemate to a party. When I worked for a newspaper, there was a party that was being thrown among our coworkers, and I brought my housemate to this particular party. And my housemate, he knows how to move around from person to person. And I think by the time this party ended, he actually knew more people at this party than I did, even though it was a party for my place of employment. And at one point during the party, I was over in the corner with one of my coworkers, and he was looking at my housemate, and he was saying, "Look at that guy. He just oozes charm." And he says, "Why can't I be like that? Why can't I be like that?" And a lot of us wonder, looking at someone like that, or looking at someone who has some kind of successful relationship, why can't I be like that? Well, I would advise you, for those of you who are single, this relates to both single people and married people, this whole text does, but speaking to the single people now, look for someone who responds to you. That doesn't mean that person is going to respond readily and immediately. Nevertheless, many years have been forfeited by people who will not let go of lost causes, who will obsess over one individual year after year after year without letting it go. And let me say to you that one of your biggest challenges, if you ever do meet the right person, may be simply to accept the love that that person has for you. And this challenge continues well into marriage, oftentimes for many people, simply to accept the love of this person who was before me. And if you are always working for love, and if you are always trying to be somebody else in order to get love, if you ever get love, who is it that they're loving? Is it you or the person that you tried to be? It gets very confusing when you start becoming a slave, when you start working. When we look at it this way, love becomes our wage. And when we don't get love, when we don't get the relationship that we want, we feel as if some kind of contract has been violated. We feel as if we have done our part. We have worked hard. We have transformed ourselves if we needed to do that. We have put out the right feelers. We have gone to the reality TV game show. Whatever we have done, we feel like we have done what we needed to do, and God has not come through on His end of the bargain. We feel as if a contract has been violated. Or perhaps we think we are a good person. We therefore deserve a good relationship. And perhaps we look out at others who don't seem to be as godly as we are, who have satisfying relationships, and we feel that somehow God has been asleep or God is punishing us in some way. We look at love as payment for services rendered. And if we do that, if we ever do find that person, this person then becomes a possession, or perhaps even an obsession instead of a partner. Well, fortunately, the Lord is good to us. The Lord is with us. The Lord disciplines us in His love. The Lord forms us for Himself. We reap what we sow, and we sow what we have reaped, just like Jacob. What we have done to others is now done to us. What has been done to us, we now do to others. You see, people who have been mistreated the way Jacob was are more likely to mistreat others. That's why one of the first things I do in premarital counseling is I have each member of the couple walk me through their childhood years. How was it that your parents treated you? Did they love you? Did you receive love? Did you understand that they loved you? Did they mistreat you in any way? Did they abuse you in any way? Because that person, if that person has been damaged in their childhood years, is going to probably have a little more difficulty moving into marriage and receiving love and not working for love and not trying to be somebody else in order to get love. Well, when we reap what we have sowed and we sow what we have reaped, we are supposed to feel some pain. We are supposed to feel the pain that we have received ourselves and that we are now inflicting upon others. We are supposed to feel how much, feel something of the damage that we have done to other people. But the Lord, in all of this, in showing us who we are, in showing us what we have done, forms us for Himself. He disciplines us. Listen to a couple of verses from Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 6. For those whom the Lord loves, He disciplines. Discipline is because of the love of the Lord. And He scourges every son whom He receives. Hebrews 12, verses 11 and 13. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. Therefore, strengthen the hands that are weak and the knees that are feeble, and make straight paths for your feet, so that the limb which is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Some would throw away marriage if affections grow cold, if appearances fade, if the relationship becomes too difficult. But if we were to throw away marriage, we are to throw away the Lord's discipline. We are to throw away the Lord's love. We are to throw away the Lord's healing. Some people look at marriage as a prison. And for those who are trapped in what feels like loveless relationships, perhaps marriage does in fact feel like a prison. Jacob wanted so much more for his relationship with Leah. He didn't want Leah in the first place. He wanted so much more for his marriage. But the Lord, in this apparently loveless relationship, was actually preparing Jacob for more. He was preparing Jacob to receive the Lord in deeper parts of his being and to take his place as a leader among God's people who would beget rulers, who would beget the nation that would save all nations. In marriage and in our desire for marriage, God is preparing us as well. He is showing us that He can work any place, even in the darkest prison, and He is preparing us for Himself and for us to take our place in His kingdom. Here's a wedding feast that ends in heartbreak. Total heartbreak. Jacob consummates the marriage with the wrong woman and ends up trapped in a loveless relationship. Many of our dreams gather around marriage, don't they? Marriage and family. We have great hopes, great dreams for marriage. But sometimes those dreams turn into nightmares. I would say about 15 to 20 years before I got married to my wife, Karen, I had a recurring nightmare. It wasn't always the same dream. In fact, it never was the same dream, but it was always the same theme, and it went like this. In my dream, I was engaged to be married to somebody. Some point after engaged, I kind of cavalierly proposed to somebody. At some point after that, I became aware that this was all a terrible mistake, and there was no way that I could get out of it. And so the wedding day is becoming closer and closer, and I am panicking more and more. I can't get out of this. I'm trapped in this. And do you know how you, well, they say anyway, this has happened to me, when you have a dream and you're going to die in a dream, you actually never die. You always wake up before that. Well, I would always wake up before I got married. Not that I was afraid of getting married or anything. I had no problems with that whatsoever. I had no fear. I had every confidence, and it was easy for me to move toward marriage. Not exactly. Thankfully, praise God, God has shown me through the wife that He has given me that there is really nothing to fear. And this morning, as my little girl, 15 months old, wakes up, and I pick her up, and I hold her, and I cradle, and I get her a bottle, and I feed her, and I hand her off to my wife because I have to get ready to be here with you this morning. And Christina, when she wants the music on, she'll go like this. She'll point to the radio or the CD player, she'll go the stereo, she'll go like this. She'll point and she's got this big smile. Would you please? It's kind of a desperate, like, please turn it on for me. And so Karen turned on the music. And then when she wants to dance, she starts going like this. She's in Karen's arms and she's dancing. And so as I joined the two of them and we danced in a three-person embrace, it occurs to me that God has turned my nightmares into a dream. Well, some of us have never partaken of the marriage feast and would really like to. Some of us have partaken of the marriage feast but would hardly call it a feast. Some of us have feasted in marriage and still find ourselves wanting for something more, wanting for something beyond the thing that marriage is, because marriage is pointing beyond itself. For all of us then, we can look forward to the marriage supper of the Lamb. That's what John calls it. The Apostle John calls it in Revelation chapter 19, the marriage supper of the Lamb, when Jesus comes back for us, transforms this place, the new heavens and the new earth. And on that day, Jesus will not be veiled or hiding as Leah was. We won't be drunk or oblivious as Jacob was. The scriptures tell us that we will see Jesus just as he is, and that we will see Jesus face to face. What will we see when we look into that face? Affirmation. Approval. Delight. Absolutely pure and holy, soul-piercing, soul-affirming love. And when that day comes, none of us will feel like we are getting less than what we bargained for. All of us will know that we're getting more than we deserve. And on that day, all of our indiscretions, all of our missteps, all of our sins, all of the things that we might regret will be swallowed up in the marriage supper of the Lamb. I'd like to invite our servers to come forward, and we are going to partake of the Lord's table, which does two things. It looks back to the sacrifice of Jesus, but it also looks forward. It looks onward to the marriage supper of the Lamb. When we partake of Jesus together as this global community, and all our dreams are fulfilled in ways that we can't begin to imagine.